Model Test 5. Part 2. Listening Comprehension. Section A. Directions. In this section, you will hear 8 short conversations and 2 long conversations. At the end of each conversation, 1 or more questions will be asked about what was said. Both the conversation and the questions will be spoken only once. After each question, there will be a pause. During the pause, you must read the 4 choices marked A, B, C, and D, and decide which is the best answer. Then mark the corresponding letter on answer sheet 1 with a single line through the center. Now let's begin with the 8 short conversations.
Question 1.
I got a C again in the maths exam. What do you think I should do?
Well, to tell you the truth, maths is a paper tiger. Its natural enemy is adequate practice.
What does the woman mean?
Question 2.
Are you moving to the suburbs with your wife? I could never leave the city. It's too convenient here.
Not for me. We want to have kids soon, and we think it'll be better for them to grow up in the quiet calm of the suburbs.
What do we learn from the conversation?
Question 3.
I'm going to book a train ticket 10 days in advance because it happens to be Christmas. How about you?
Don't worry, there will be extra trains added to the original schedule.
What does the woman imply?
Question 4.
Andy, are you busy right now? I'd like to talk with you again about what happened.
Oh, again? Is it necessary, dear? Come on, let's not beat a dead horse.
What does the man mean?
Question 5.
What's your plan for this weekend? I think it would be fun if we all go to watch that new movie downtown.
Count me out. I've heard it's not worth the money.
What does the woman mean?
Question 6.
Henry studies so hard that he's just like a bookworm. He's always studying even after class.
I think a good student should study hard and not study all the time. I'll speak to him.
What does the man feel about Henry?
Question 7.
How is your sister? Is she still selling mobile phones?
She has had 3 different jobs. Right now, she is working in an electronics company. Before then, she was selling office equipment.
What job does the woman's sister have now?
Question 8.
Mr. Lee, right? Very pleased to meet you. And what kind of things do you write?
Well, short stories mainly. Actually, at the moment, I'm writing a travel book.
What do we learn about the man? Now you'll hear the two long conversations. Conversation 1.
Is this the workshop to prepare for an interview? I am trying to find the class preparing for interviews.
This is the interview class. Welcome to our class.
I am really excited to be taking this workshop so that I can get ready for my interview next week.
This is the right place. Please join us.
Frankly speaking, I am really nervous about this interview, so I hope I can learn everything quickly.
There are all learning things that will help us in our interviews. What do you think are some important considerations for your interview?
I think that we should dress neatly and appropriately. Our dress and appearance are probably the most important things by which an interviewer judges us.
Yes, you are right. We should make sure that our looks are the best they can be. Secondly, as you can imagine, attitude and friendliness go a long way.
Yes, they help establish a friendly tone for the rest of the interview, and I always feel much better when I am friendly.
Believe it or not, the interviewers are as interested in your questions as they are in your answers.
Any more hints as to what I should do in an interview?
Always be honest about your answers. The interviewers really do want to know if you will be a good fit for them.
What else should I keep in mind?
Just relax and be yourself. You can make it. Good luck.
Questions 9 to 11 are based on the conversation you have just heard.
Question 9.
What is this workshop for?
Question 10.
What does the man think is the most important for interviewers' judgment?
Question 11.
Why does the man think attitude and friendliness help?
Conversation 2. Hey, what's the news? You look so happy.
Really?
Come on, it's written all over your face.
Oh, well, I'm still in shock. I just got the green light from admissions.
Fantastic! What do you get, your fellowship, assistantship, or scholarship?
They offer me a full scholarship. It's much better than I've hoped for. It will cover tuition, room, and board. With that, I won't have to sponge off my folks.
Could you talk with me about scholarships, assistantships, and fellowships?
Okay. Financial aid in the form of scholarships, assistantships, grants, etc. is available to students.
Yes, I'd like you to define them more specifically.
Fellowships, scholarships, assistantships, and others are awarded on the basis of merit and do not normally require an analysis of financial need. Fellowships are assigned to full-time students of high academic standard, the amount ranging from $600 to $800.
What about the others?
All scholarships provide tuition expense only and require full-time graduate status. Assistantships are made up of three types: teaching, research, and graduate. Only full-time graduate students are qualified for assistantships.
Any requirements for them?
Yes, assistantship holders are required to teach 20 hours or to do 20 hours of research a week. All assistantships carry an allowance, and most provide a tuition relief. Assistants are required to carry 9 graduate credit hours to be considered full-time.
I take it for granted that you have got the scholarship. Am I hopeful to get full scholarship?
If you want to qualify for the scholarship, you must study hard and get the highest score.
Questions 12 to 15 are based on the conversation you have just heard.
Question 12.
Why is the man so happy?
Question 13.
How are all forms of financial aid awarded?
Question 14.
What do we learn about scholarship?
Question 15.
What are the assistantship holders required to do? Section B. Directions. In this section, you will hear 3 short passages. At the end of each passage, you will hear some questions. Both the passage and the questions will be spoken only once. After you hear a question, you must choose the best answer from the 4 choices marked A, B, C, and D. Then mark the corresponding letter on answer sheet 1 with a single line through the center.
Passage 1. In 1879, Oxford University in England asked Professor James Murray to serve as an editor for what was to be the most ambitious dictionary in the history of the English language. It would include every English word possible and would give not only the definition, but also the history of the word and quotations showing how it was used. This was a huge task, so Murray had to find volunteers from Britain, the United States, and the British colonies to search every newspaper, magazine, and book ever written in English. Hundreds of volunteers responded, including William Chester Minor. Dr. Minor was an American surgeon who had served in the Civil War and was now living in England. He gave his address as Broadmoor, Crowthorne, Berkshire, 50 miles from Oxford. Minor joined the army of volunteers, sending words and quotations to Murray. Over the next years, he became one of the staff's most valued contributors, but he was also a mystery. In spite of many invitations, he would always decline to visit Oxford. So, in 1897, Murray finally decided to travel to Crowthorne himself. When he arrived, he found Minor locked in a book-lined cell at the Broadmoor Mental Hospital for the criminally insane. Murray and Minor became friends, sharing their love of words. Minor continued contributing to the dictionary, sending in more than 10,000 entries in 20 years. Murray continued to visit Minor regularly, sometimes taking walks with him around. Minor died in 1920, 7 years before the first edition of the Oxford English Dictionary was completed.
Questions 16 to 18
are based on the passage you have just heard.
Question 16.
How did Minor contribute to the dictionary?
Question 17.
Why did Minor refuse Murray's invitations?
Question 18.
What do we learn about Minor?
Passage 2. Fear and its companion, pain, are two of the most useful things that man and animals possess if they are used. If fire didn't hurt when it burned, children would play with it until their hands were burned away. Similarly, if pain existed but fear didn't, a child could burn itself again and again because fear would not warn it to keep away from the fire that had burnt it before. Fear and pain are therefore two guards without which man and animals might soon die out. We suggested that fear ought to be properly used. If, for example, you never go out of your house because of the danger of being knocked down in the street by a car, you are letting fear rule you too much. The important thing is not to let fear rule you, but instead to use fear as your servant and guide. Fear will warn you of dangers. Then you have to decide what action to take. In many cases, you can take quick and successful action to avoid the danger. For example, you see a car coming straight towards you. Fear warns you. You jump out of the way, and all is well. In some cases, however, you decide that there is nothing that you can do to avoid the danger. For example, you can't prevent an airplane crashing into your house, and you may not want to live in a desert where there are no airplanes. In this case, fear has given you its warning. You have examined it and decided on your course of action. So fear of the particular danger is no longer of any use to you, and you have to try to overcome it.
Questions 19 to 21
are based on the passage you have just heard.
Question 19.
What will probably happen if playing with fire causes pain but no fear?
Question 20.
How can fear be correctly used?
Question 21.
Why can people avoid dangers in time in many cases? Passage 3. Arthur Miller is universally recognized as one of the greatest dramatists of the 20th century. Miller's father had moved to the USA from Austria-Hungary, drawn, like so many others, by the great American dream. However, he experienced severe financial hardship when his family business was ruined in the Great Depression of the early 1930s. Miller's most famous play, Death of a Salesman, is a powerful attack on the American system, with its aggressive way of doing business and its insistence on money and social status as an index of worth. In Willie Loman, the hero of the play, we see a man who has got into trouble with this system. Willie is burnt out, and in the cruel world of business, there is no room for emotion. If he can't do the work, then he is no good to his employer, the Wagner Company, and he must go. Willie is painfully aware of this, and at a loss as to what to do with his lack of success. He refuses to face the fact that he has failed and kills himself in the end. When it was first staged in 1949, the play was greeted with good reviews and it won the Tony Award for Best Play, the New York Drama Critics Circle Award, and the Pulitzer Prize for Drama. It was the first play to win all three of these major awards. Miller died of heart failure at his home in Roxbury, Connecticut, on the evening of February 10, 2005.
Questions 22 to 25
are based on the passage you have just heard.
Question 22.
Why did Miller's father move to the USA?
Question 23.
What does Death of a Salesman mainly reveal?
Question 24.
Why does Willie in Willie Loman commit suicide finally?
Question 25.
What do we learn about Miller? Section C. Directions. In this section, you will hear a passage three times. When the passage is read for the first time, you should listen carefully for its general idea. When the passage is read for the second time, you are required to fill in the blanks with the exact words you have just heard. Finally, when the passage is read for the third time, you should check what you have written. Now listen to the passage.
Most parents, I suppose, have had the experience of reading a bedtime story to their children, and they must have realized how difficult it is to find a good children's book. Either the author has aimed too high so that the children can't follow what is in his or more often her story, or the story seems to be talking to the readers. The best children's books are neither very difficult nor very simple, and satisfy both the child who hears the story and the adult who reads it. Unfortunately, there are in fact few books like this, so the problem of finding the right bedtime story is not easy to solve. This may be why many of books regarded as works of children's literature were in fact written for the grown. Alice's Adventure in Wonderland is perhaps the most obvious of this. Children, left for themselves, often show the worst possible interest in literature. Just leave a child in a bookshop or a library, and he will more willingly choose the books written in an imaginative way, or have a look at most children's comics, full of the stories and jokes which are the objections of teachers and right-thinking parents. Perhaps we parents should stop trying to force children into accepting our taste in literature. After all, children and adults are so different that we parents should not expect that they will enjoy the same books. So I suppose we'll just have to compromise over that bedtime story.
Now the passage will be read again. Most parents, I suppose, have had the experience of reading a bedtime story to their children, and they must have realized how difficult it is to find a good children's book. Either the author has aimed too high so that the children can't follow what is in his, or more often, her story, or the story seems to be talking to the readers. The best children's books are neither very difficult nor very simple, and satisfy both the child who hears the story and the adult who reads it. Unfortunately, there are in fact few books like this, so the problem of finding the right bedtime story is not easy to solve. This may be why many of books regarded as works of children's literature were in fact written for the grown. Alice's Adventure in Wonderland is perhaps the most obvious of this. Children, left for themselves, often show the worst possible interest in literature. Just leave a child in a bookshop or a library, and he will more willingly choose the books written in an imaginative way. Or have a look at most children's comics, full of the stories and jokes which are the objections of teachers and right-thinking parents. Perhaps we parents should stop trying to force children into accepting our taste in literature. After all, children and adults are so different that we parents should not expect that they will enjoy the same books. So I suppose we'll just have to compromise over that bedtime story. Now the passage will be read for the third time.
Most parents, I suppose, have had the experience of reading a bedtime story to their children. And they must have realized how difficult it is to find a good children's book. Either the author has aimed too high so that the children can't follow what is in his or more often her story, or the story seems to be talking to the readers. The best children's books are neither very difficult nor very simple, and satisfy both the child who hears the story and the adult who reads it. Unfortunately, there are in fact few books like this. So the problem of finding the right bedtime story is not easy to solve. This may be why many of books regarded as works of children's literature were in fact written for the grown. Alice's Adventure in Wonderland is perhaps the most obvious of this. Children, left for themselves, often show the worst possible interest in literature. Just leave a child in a bookshop or a library, and he will more willingly choose the books written in an imaginative way, or have a look at most children's comics, full of the stories and jokes which are the objections of teachers and right-thinking parents. Perhaps we parents should stop trying to force children into accepting our taste in literature. After all, children and adults are so different that we parents should not expect that they will enjoy the same books. So I suppose we'll just have to compromise over that bedtime story.
This is the end of Listening Comprehension.